Ready? I can do it. So I'm going to talk about NUMA, but mostly to get a discussion going. And I find if you start over that the same croissant that you had is bothering you again. There must be something. Mostly I want to get a discussion going as to what we can do in FreeBSD to support it better. I'm definitely not here to tell you all about it, about NUMA, because I don't want to claim that I know a lot about it. I haven't at least read any or a lot of the 20 years' worth of papers that have been written about it. So as I already said, the compute node looks pretty standard. CPU front-side bus and a chipset. At the conceptual level, if you bundle it into a single package, you call that a CPU, you get pretty close to what AMD's Direct Connect architecture is or Intel's QuickPath Interconnect, which is all about eliminating the front-side bus. But it is about having an X number of cores / CPUs with local memory and some interconnect, whether you call it a hypertransport or a NUMA link, that allows you to connect to other nodes or chips with their own local memory and the inherent cost of having to go to the remote memory versus having to talk to your local memory. That fundamentally is, I think, if I understand it all correctly, the NUMA problem. It is understanding the global memory, physical memory, enough that you know what is local, where you incur the least amount of cost to access it versus what is remote, and how much cost you incur accessing the remote, and optimizing the system in such a way that you maximize accesses to local memory. Some elementary mechanisms or methods have been tried and implemented. One of them is replication, which works well for text or read-only data. You know it doesn't change. You can replicate it across the nodes, and all the CPUs in the different nodes can access that same data in local memory, eliminating the need to go across the NUMA link or a hypertransport to remote nodes. Data migration is another such technique, a little bit harder, I would say, because it requires you to know or understand where the data is being referenced from most so that you can bring that data closest to where it's used most. There is a third thing that can be done, but I think that's mostly at the development or the developer level, or maybe the source code level, and I'm not really going to talk about it. Fundamentally, I think the problem is that if you combine data that is mostly accessed by one node or read-only and have it in close proximity of data that you share, you get false sharing of the data that's either read-only or accessed from one node only. And if you can eliminate that, you can maximize the local accesses. So one key aspect is that in a CZ NUMA system, there's a global shared memory. On the LTIX, it's implemented very trivially. The first the least significant 38 bits are a node offset and address space. Bits 39 to 50 is the node ID. And that basically carves out the global physical address space into 256 gigabyte chunks, of which, unfortunately, by way of how they chose the address space, the upper 64 gigabyte actually represents memory, which means that if you look at the physical memory map of a NUMA system, the first 192 gigabytes is, well, not usable. And that kind of caused some problems with FreeBSD because we linked the kernel at the direct mapped virtual address, and we assumed that there was memory at 64 megabyte. So the very first task that had to be done to get FreeBSD booting is, okay, we need to eliminate the assumption that there is memory low enough or at a certain point. So to get FreeBSD booting, the EFI loader had to be changed, And given that you can't really depend anymore on where physical memory is, the best thing to do is use the EFI physical memory allocator. That gives you memory chunks that are actually there, which means you need to deal with the non-deterministic nature of the physical addresses. You can't really use a direct map virtual address that you use to link the kernel against. As such, I implemented what I called a pre-boot virtual memory system. It's actually paged, and the kernel is linked against a virtual address. It's paged, the loader builds a page table, it allocates the memory physically and maps it in the page table. And to support the page size, which is unlike the standard constant within FreeBSD that defines the page size used by the kernel, I had to change the loader a bit to make sure that we had the proper alignment. But also I wanted to make sure that after we have loaded a segment out of an ELF file, we could set the permissions properly in the page table and or flush iCaches or synchronize iCaches. So besides having a pure virtual page-based memory system in the loader with some other changes, we ended up with the flexibility to boot on pretty much anything, and the loader maps the page table, most of the text, the beginning of data, and then jumps into the kernel. The upside of all of this is that we have everything in place to actually replicate the kernel text across nodes, because we have a virtual memory infrastructure, we have a page table that you can duplicate, and you can just copy the read-only pages into nodes, change the page table, and have one aspect of the NUMA problem solved, at least for the kernel. This hasn't been implemented yet because, well, I had bigger problems to solve. That is just getting things working. Device enumeration it's standard in the sense that once you know how to talk to the hardware, you can find your PCI buses, you can enumerate, scan, get the devices. But the problem is, it always happens by or on the BSP. And if you enumerate devices, you get to see the devices that are attached to different nodes as well. And that gets a bit complicated in the sense that you really want to have the data that a driver is using close to the CPU that actually runs that driver or where you have your interrupts delivered to. But we don't have the control yet in FreeBSD to do that. So you can have the BSP do the enumeration and create some complicated interface that says allocate memory, but it really needs to be somewhere over there. There are other ways to do it. So I thought about it and came up with something, well, I call that the allocation principle, which may be totally bogus, but that's why I like to have this discussion. If you assume that you have maximum locality of reference already at this time, then if you're asked to allocate memory, you preserve that property by allocating local to the CPU you're running on right now. Which means if the allocator always gives you a chunk of memory that physically close to the CPU where the memory is allocated on, you have basic properties that I think work well without any change whatsoever in interfaces. And if you start with that principle, I'm hoping that you just need a few interfaces for those cases where you really know up front that you want to allocate it at a different node, i.e. from a different chunk of physical memory. What, for example, we can do in the FreeBSD kernel with malloc is add a flag to malloc that says allocate this close to the CPU, which is the default behavior, but fail when you can't, or just allocate somewhere else if there isn't anything free local. That may be enough to have this be usable. In that sense, if a device driver needs to have memory local, and it absolutely needs to be local, you can fill the allocation. But in most cases, you can just say, well, it's the best effort anyway. Yes? But
if you don't know where it's going, you don't want to put it
right.
This is far bad.
You actually then need to say where you want it, I would say. Because on especially the LTX 350, you can have an X number of nodes. They're all connected to a link. So the further away from the node you need to talk to, the more expensive it is. So you can't just then make a decision, oh, I go to the closest node next to it. Because you may know up front that you're going to allocate memory that is actually mostly being used the furthest node. So, that's where things get complicated if you know that it shouldn't be on this node. You need to actually say, I think, then where you want it to be, because you should then have enough information. So with this allocation principle sort of as the baseline of rethinking the device enumeration, yes. So the S-hub driver that actually controls the whole NUMA cluster and handles the control, it seems a bit difficult to have its soft C, for example, in a node if you need to configure it, for example. I think for the LTX that's not really the problem, but in general, it seems like a good idea to be able to say this piece of hardware can't work across the NUMA link because, for example, it is really the one controlling it and it needs to have certain data, DMA buffers, local so that it can do its work.
Are you aware of the charter? In AMD, we never, it's an optimization, but never, in CC NUMA, every process was supposed to be cached compared to any other memory expensively.
Yeah, but that's, you mentioned process. This is really where you are at the lowest layers with device drivers that, control the system. And I can imagine that if performance is critical and you have a particular device in node X and interrupts go there, that there may absolutely no point that you need to go over the link to access data somewhere else. So the thought of at least having the flag seemed reasonable.
What seems like if you had a very bandwidth intensive application, say streaming data off the network onto a disk, both of those on the same PCI bus in a particular node, and you knew that the arrangement could work that bandwidth, but if you had to go DMA and memory back and back, and you couldn't possibly support your application, you'd rather fail.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's
an
example.
Yeah.
That's where you want that flag.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah.
Well, it seems like you'd also want, you know, if say you were pushing data, you'd rather have a small local buffer than the size you wanted remotely.
Yes. Yes. Through, yes. Through yeah. Okay. And in the cases where you know that there is no point for local memory, it seemed at least reasonable to have a flag that says, okay, rather fail, and you can do something else instead. Yes.
Stuff.
Yes.
And that is something like we need to spend a bit of time.
Yes. So I didn't mention that here, but on the LTX there is the SRAD table, which we already have support for in X86 in current. I'm sure if you talk about some random other architecture, there's another way, but yes. We need some notion of nodes, costs, and size and location of memory to in general, deal with it. But
the SRAD table doesn't give you that, but it's not a nice data structure for making a closed system, you couldn't get an exact node.
Yeah.
You know, they had nice data structures that described quickly what's the next best thing.
Yeah.
In head, we kind of have that.
Yeah.
Each domain has its own lookup list for allocation.
Yeah. Yeah, Joe. I haven't even gotten to this point yet, so I'm actually trying to get some of the basics done. See if, for example, something like an allocation principle would be a good baseline for making further decisions in what we need to do. I mean, that could be totally bogus to begin with, and I would presume that you do want to have the ability to say, okay, it's fine if this particular thread schedules across cores or CPUs within the same node, you know, that there isn't a lot of impact. But you...
It's important, but if you make a decision that this thread has to be migrated to another CPU,
yeah,
should we prefer the CPU the allocated memory on?
Or yes.
Well,
could you reschedule, yes.
No, that's not necessarily true.
Right.
Really depends. There's a cost benefit analysis to how expensive the remote memory gets.
Yeah.
For example, x86, it's almost never true that you want to actually move memory. There's a way that the cost of moving the memory is so much more expensive than the relative cost of it for
memory. Well, he said we prefer the node that's got the memory when you reschedule.
Yes,
but it's
still variable. It depends on what the relative cost is.
And I can imagine that it also goes the other way around, because if you have everything allocated on one node and then decide that everything needs to be scheduled there, I don't think you have a good separation of work across your nodes. Yes, sorry, you wanted to ask the question for a while. Yes.
Instead of actually trying to make them look like they're one computer.
Yes. Except this is cache coherent. If you talk about those clusters, it isn't generally cache coherent unless you have a lot of additional overhead. I don't know if... Do you know of a cluster that is cache coherent?
No, I didn't think they've gone that far.
Okay. Sorry? Oh, what is the question? Hey, Robert. No, not yet. I'm basically just tipping my toes in and being faced with questions. And this is where I'd like to get the feedback about what other people have in their environment, what we may want to support that makes different architectures work. So I haven't looked at it. If you can send me pointers, I can definitely take a look at it. No, because I have no idea how they work yet, and I actually haven't gotten that far.
So the i7 Uncore events will tell you that. So I imagine if Intel has bothered to put it in the i7 chips, you probably can get it off of the Itanium chips as well.
I think that the SuperHub has counters for it. I just don't know yet how to interpret it. And I have bigger problems to solve, so... Yeah, I need to get to that point eventually, if I ever get to that point. Yeah. I sent an email to Julian and John about the possible existence of some virtualization environment maybe even using a standard network, that makes it a little bit easier to analyze what goes on. We weren't aware of anything. So, yeah, I don't know if there's any. I think it is when you really are working on the performance and tuning it, those are very important things to have to work with. Otherwise, it's really difficult to see if anything you do makes any impact whatsoever. Yeah.
But the question then is, you know, is that useful for getting results on other real hardware?
The only hardware I know of is either cache coherent NUMA or distributed memory
at
this point.
Yeah.
You know, the UV is ultraviolence or cache coherent.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the other hand, most of all the cores coming onto one die, you have coherence in that space, at least for the processors I know about. So I don't know how much we need to design for it.
Yeah.
Or unless the Intel cloud computing thing that Robert was talking about is interesting.
Yeah. Having locality of reference by doing your replication or migration may probably help with whatever you need to do to deal with the non-cache coherency. But yeah, I haven't considered the non-CC variant.
What's the NUMA factor, would you estimate? The ratio of local to distance, how expensive is this?
In some cases, it was like a factor of 10 or 15, depending on how far you need to go to get the data.
Yeah. Yeah, which is interesting, because if you want to, for example, replicate your read-only data or your text to the point where you really have no memory left for any useful data and end up swapping, then you know you want to drop that. So it's interesting in the end, I think, with all the aspects that we need to consider. So let me. I think I have 5 minutes, and then I've talked for half an hour. So with that allocation principle sort of in our back pocket, it makes sense to then say, okay, why not have one core or Monarch CPU in each node do the bus enumeration for all the devices within that node, so that whatever allocation happens will be local to that node and you solve most of the problems. It sounds nice, but it creates more questions, because in order to have those threads running in all those cores or on the CPUs, you probably want your scheduler working. Your unit numbers for devices that you find become sort of non-deterministic, because you may have concurrency. Concurrency is great if you have a large cluster. If you have 128 nodes and you try to do it all serially, especially from the BSP, it starts to eat a lot of time. But yes, concurrency creates non-deterministic behavior. So how do you want to deal with that? Is it at all possible? So it does raise a few other questions, but it at least solves the problem of having the memory local to the devices where you really want it to be local without actually having to change a lot or anything. Plus, you can have the Monarch start the APs within the node, so you can just fan that out. So there may be consequences to new bus for this to work well. I personally don't mind what the unit number is on first boot, but on next boot, I really like that to be the same. So maybe that is a good enough thing to address. So In particular, so this in short is where I was or where I at. I got to the point where I can enumerate buses, I find the devices, I get to the single user mode prompt, and then I panic. The reason being that there is a special address space on the SGIL text for atomic operations, which, okay, not implemented. So atomic operations don't work. DMA doesn't work because the superhub has a physical address space presented to the hardware that is different from what the OS sees because it needs to map it to a global space. And that requires IO MMU support, and that isn't there yet. So requires work. No, the disk driver doesn't work. The BGE driver doesn't work. It's all detected nice, but that's a fundamental problem that I now need to first work on. I haven't worried about the replication so much because that seems like, okay, I have bigger problems. The memory allocation control, in particular, when you know it needs to go somewhere or where you actually get to the point that, hey, I'm starting processes and I have a multi-threaded process that runs a thread on each CPU, what to do there? I haven't reached that point. And data migration is then, well, even further beyond that. My next focus will be on DMA, bus DMA. My plan is to unify all the machine-specific bus DMA implementations into an MI implementation that supports bounce buffering as well as IO MMU. I think we just have too much machine-specific code that really is not non-specific to the machine anyway. So that is probably an item that I want to push in 10. Hopefully that will help, especially the Tier 2 platforms with having good bus DMA implementations. From there I'll see how it goes. Probably just the atomic operations and get the basic stability going before I really start looking further into the NUMA considerations. So from here on, I just have a lot of items that mostly are questions that I would have liked to see discussed or still like to see discussed, which is, for example, do we want to have the scheduler running early? Do we want to have multiple CPUs running bus enumeration concurrently so that we can easily deal with those NUMA problems, but is there a downside that is really too much for FreeBSD, or is it generally useful? I don't know if people have opinions or on that. It is generally just difficult to parallelize enumeration of devices, but if we feel that it is a good thing to do, if we want to support massive, clustered machines or so, then that is one way I think we should go. If malloc doesn't necessarily need any changes because you always allocate local to the machine, that is physically local to the machine, we do probably need some interfaces that allow us to allocate physical memory that is somewhere remote and particularly somewhere else. Alan did some good work, initial work of having the physical memory controlled much better with domains and free lists. So we probably want to extend an interface there that allows us to allocate memory. I think the contact malloc already uses it. So a separate or additional interface that allows us to say I want it there would really help. Is there something that we may want to add to NewBus to have knowledge that, for example, a Nexus bus or a NUMA controller has automatically propagated down to devices? I mean, there will be an impact on bus DMA, on DMA in general. It makes sense to me, at least, that you want to do DMA to memory that's local to the device. I don't know if there is a value to just DMA memory to some remote node where it's being used locally from there on. I have no idea what the performance impacts or consequences are. David?
On this machine, are buses, PCI buses, PCI Express, are they through a Nexus or are they local to CPU?
they are local to the node, and that's the chipset, and therefore they're local to a few CPUs that are connected to that chipset.
Okay, so you can have buses that are very far apart.
Yes, yes. And they actually share the same device, the visible address range. So there needs to be a translation even in the resource allocation to make sure that it maps properly in the global address space as the OS sees it. Other things that I had that were interesting to discuss, I would say, is how and when do we replicate text? What do we do with the read-only data? The scheduling question, obviously. Do you want more flexibility to schedule across nodes? Do you want to, for example, move the struct proc or struct threads to where you have that process running? Seems a bit excessive if you're going to schedule back to the node you were running on to begin with. But for long-running jobs, like massive matrix multiplications, I can imagine that there is an impact to actually incur that one-time overhead and not have to worry about it. How to implement it is obviously a question that I don't know if people have thought about it or have ideas about. Do we need some additional synchronization primitives or so that help us with certain things? Non-uniform nodes is, for example, when an additional node has CPUs with different frequencies or a clock with different frequencies. And in particular for the LTX 350, if there's a different version of the S-hub that creates a different physical address map, is that something we want to worry about? Or is that just really so much on the side that it's, okay, don't worry about it, we'll focus on the uniform configurations. I had a question about MPI. I basically don't know anything about that, but it is being used in clusters, and I'd like to know what the typical consequences are if you really want to get to the point of supporting that. Is there something we need to do in the kernel or so? The soft partitioning, it's the CPU budgeting, is that something you really must have then or really highly desirable? I think we want it for other reasons as well, so it's also fine that we can just assume that it's there. And that's mostly what I had. Does anyone have an answer for my questions?
42.
I assume that other people have been thinking about this and have some ideas. I think what I want to take away from this is get the people with an interest, with the hardware, with a need, and just get together and come up with a plan, a roadmap, a direction, and just go from there. I will probably be happily hacking on the LTX because I think there's value in having something that is weird or just not something that everyone else is using, just to make sure that your architecture and infrastructure in FreeBSD is sufficiently generic. Next gen? Oh yeah, I can definitely do that. I have a wiki page for the LTX specific, but having one that is more generically speaking about NUMA and where we can dump references to papers would definitely be a good idea. So yeah, I'll start that one. So if no one has any answers, a question.
Yeah. Or assuredly some.
Yeah.
It takes them forever to get a new release out.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, as I said, it's I have no idea really what the particular aspects of MPI are that you want to address, where you want to have your performance tuned or so. But yeah, that's definitely an idea. Just look at what's out there and what's needed. And
Open MPI has got a pretty modular decomposition, so you should be able to look at, okay, here's what they did on this NUMA architecture, and here's what they did on InfiniBand or something.
Yeah.
To give you an idea of what they did differently.
Yeah, yeah.
Too much pain.
Yeah.
Some of the older ones are pretty monolithic.
Yeah. I can imagine that different latencies of the different interconnects may require you to do things a little bit differently. To what extent or how, I don't know. So, yeah. Other answers? Maybe questions then? Okay, thank you.
Okay, can I go?
Yes.
Okay. So, the question that people ask lately is how to make GEM go faster, because, of course, with regular hard drives, there is no problem, but when you go to SSDs or even Fusion IOs, IO cards, you have to handle huge amount IO requests per second, and GEOM has some issues with that, because with GEOM we use two kernel threads, one to pass all IO requests down the stack and one to pass all IO requests back. So if we have a lot of requests, those two threads are CPU bound and we are quite limited. So this is this will show what's the theoretical limit on GEOM performance when we do direct IO request dispatching and when we basically avoid those G-up and G-down threads. And of course, this is not on the real hardware. I'm using a G0 class, which basically the only thing it does, it delivers the answer without doing anything at all. So this will tell us what's the limit. We won't be able to to exceed. Okay, so the test system has four cores, so the numbers we will be looking at are for four processes running in parallel. So we start at the default configuration of Geom. We have statistics collection turned on, and I use write test to verify, to check how much I/O requests per second Geom can handle. And here you can see how many processes I was using to actually generate the load. So as you can see, it does scale a bit, but the limit here for four processes is 150,000 requests per second, which is a bit low. Fusion.io claims to get around 400K IOPS per second. Is that right?
In some of the experimental stuff, it's like we actually tell people that we get like just over 100,000 operations per second, but you know, how much stuff that?
Yeah, if we have multiple cards going with our system, we easily.
Yeah, as per card, so if you could put like four or five cards in, then.
Yeah, and with current Geom limits, we won't be able to get past this number. So, okay, so we will start from turning statistics collection off. As you can see, statistics collections adds overhead because we need to get accurate time for each of the I/O requests, and this is quite expensive. As you can see, when we turn off statistics collection, it gets around 10% faster. The next thing I did was to implement a hack which basically sends I/O requests directly and don't use gup and gdown threads at all. And this makes things go faster quite a bit. Even for one process, you can see that we can do 500k IOPS per second. So we are much, much quicker. This is for four processes.
What size am I up?
512 bytes. So the smallest we can get. But
there's
there's
a fall off as you get.
Yeah, there is. There is small fall off, but the more important thing is that we don't scale. For one for one process, we get more or less the same amount of I/O requests as for four processes, so we don't scale at all. And the problem here was, first problem here was that I was using directly G0 device from DevFS, and this hits the Dev Mutex, which is a global mutex protecting all the DevFS nodes. That's why we couldn't scale. There is a flag to tell DevFS that the given device will never disappear. And this eliminates a lot of synchronization that is normally used. So with this flag set, of course it's not safe to set this flag for Geom providers, but I wanted to get the raw numbers, because all I do here, I wanted to add hacks to actually eliminate all the contention points that are not relevant for file systems. Because if we access Geom providers from a file system, we don't go through DevFS and stuff like that. So we want to just avoid this. So after adding this flag, we are about 30% faster. And as you can see, we scale a bit better. Okay, another bottleneck I hit was pbuffs. Pbuffs have also global mutex that protects all the pbuffs list. And after splitting all the pbuffs and making the lists per CPU, I would able to get 20% more of I/O requests per second. So we are currently at 800K IOPS per second for four processors.
Did you, by doing this, did you increase the number of PLOPs?
I didn't need to do that because I was using 16 processors at maximum. So, and we have like 256 PBuffs by default.
I run into PBuff exhaustion. I do silly things like I go in using UFS. If I go and increase the number of simultaneous, increase the amount of simultaneous IO bytes that's available, so I can queue a whole bunch of IO. Then I can start running into PBuff.
Yeah, but this workload, actually, each process is doing read and waits for the answer. So it's using one PBuff.
Yeah,
so
using it for direct IO, but using it for device direct IO, it's
Same
than doing it with through buffer system in UFS.
Yeah, so this is without file systems at all. So. Okay. Another thing I tried was to increase mutex pool size, because I saw contention there, but Ministat doesn't agree that it helps. I think there is an improvement, but the results, I couldn't stabilize the results I get. So the differences between runs were big enough to make Ministat believe there is no difference at all. If we would be able to stabilize the results, I think there will be a small difference, I guess, because there was contention. Yeah?
So this is what Doug mentioned, is that there is a drop-off in the performance between 4, 8, and 16. Do you know why that is? Do you have an explanation for that?
Not really, no.
Okay. Well, past 8 processes, you're starting to get process contention because you only have 8 cores in the test.
It might be something in scheduler or other problem. There is a drop, small but visible. Yeah.
Okay.
Until you.
I had a couple of questions on the mutex pool modifies you made. Do you know what consumer subdivision was causing the most attention?
Yeah, I think the buff locks. If you have struct buff, each one doesn't have its own mutex. They are using mutex pool, and this is where I have contention. Maybe, but I think that the main reason was that the results weren't very stable. The difference between the differences between runs were even 10%.
Yeah,
so this is really we cannot observe like 3% improvement if the difference between runs is 10%. So okay, another thing I did, but I'm afraid I wouldn't be able to explain it to you. Is to change this bit here, and this make the page lock contention much lower or invisible actually, and this gives another 4 or 5% improvement. And during Dev Summit, Alan Cox confirmed that the contention I saw was only because I was running micro benchmark, and for real low workloads, there shouldn't be any contention on VM page log. So, so this is a good thing that I was able to eliminate it, because we just want to see the limit, the theoretical limit. And this is basically the last number, the biggest number I could get, around 840,000 IOPS per second. Here you can see the difference between each of the tweaks, and that's the final result. No optimizations at all, the blue bars, and green one was with all the optimizations. So as you can see, with all the tweaks, we can get more than 4 times IOPS per second for Geon. I have one more thing to show you, because during Dev Summit, there was a question: what overhead is introduced by cloning BIOS? That's an interesting question, because each layer in Geom, if you have partitioning, Geom label and stuff like that, you have to clone BIOS at each layer. And how much overhead does it introduce? And I was able to measure that. Using G0. This is basically using just one single layer, G0, and I was using GNOP class to introduce more layers. So this is with G0.nop, G0.nop.nop, G0.nop.nop.nop, etc. So with five layers of Geom NOP, we get like 10%, we pay 10% penalty for all the biocloning and additional overhead caused by function calls and stuff like that. So I think that's not very bad, I guess. Most of the time we have like two layers or stuff like that. So.
But I can imagine that, say, a partitioning layer needs to do a little bit more work than the NOP layer.
Yeah, but... The question was, at the Dev Summit, the question was, how much overhead do we get from biocloning?
Okay.
So, of course, if there is additional work, we will pay additional cost, but...
This is the cloning.
Yeah. Okay, any questions?
So, if you want to summarize what you have found, basically, the MFS is not an issue for real world or
for real... For file systems, yeah. Actually, I cleaned up the patch a bit, and I have an idea how we can implement that. Actually, this test was done with the new patch, which is much more cleaner, and basically we have two flags for Geom class to say that, yes, I can. I know how... Maybe I will start from the beginning. Because of the Geom up and Gdown threads, we had single threads, the Geom classes could actually depend on the fact that there is a single thread doing all the IO requests going down and going up. So you could avoid some locking overhead, for example, and other synchronization. So, and I'm not sure we will be able to fix all the Geom classes in one go and audit Geom classes in one go and to tell that, okay, all Geom classes can handle IO requests coming from different threads in parallel. Maybe we will need to add some additional synchronization to them, etc. So my idea for now is to have a flag in Geom class to tell the Geom stack that, yes, I am able to handle direct IO requests going down and going up. So if you are lucky, and we will do it for Geom dev, Geom disk, and Geom part, you will be able to pass all the requests without using, with avoiding gup and gdown thread altogether. So that's the initial idea, I guess. Okay, any other questions? Okay.
So basically, all the biggest contention you see is on the BBuff and the buff log.
Yeah, most the contention I saw was because I was using DevFS entry. Yeah.
Okay, but when you build it, the biggest ones were BBuff and the buff log that were using Mutex pool, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
The Mutex one wasn't really big as you saw. Ministat couldn't see the difference, so. I don't think that's a big deal. We could have contention when we will try to use file system in other places, but I wanted to avoid file system because I didn't want it to get some false result because we use some file system caching and stuff like that. Yeah, so.
Can you bring up the last slide of the presentation that had the comparison?
This one?
Yeah.
Geom Direct IO helps the most, definitely. Yes, this is available under people.freebsd.org, pjd/geomperf.pdf. The last one is not yet uploaded, so.
You patch
this as well? No, not yet. It's almost done, but I need to pass them through Paul Henning, I guess, so. Those patches. I want to commit only one change, which is direct IO thing, because the rest I'm not sure if they are relevant actually. So that's the one I want to work on. Most of those were just hacks to make the contention points go away, so I can get the raw numbers. But
okay. So you don't see a value.
Yeah,
we want those two.
I do. I'm not sure how important that is, and actually, I'm not sure I'm the person who should work on it, because there are VM stuff that could be better used. For example, on AMD64, we could use direct mapping, for example, and stuff like that, which I'm not really want to work on, so.
Send it to Max.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
I really wanted to see the numbers related to UFS and buffer cache actually buy. I mean, you just wanted to do a lot of things. It's okay.
Yeah.